Imagine right now, you just walked into a dimly lit barn. It's freezing, it smells faintly of wet wool, and right in the middle of the room is an alpaca. But not just any alpaca. This one is glowing.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's emitting this pulsating neon green radioactive light. Now, the guy standing next to you, who smells like, you know, cheap cologne and desperation, he slaps the hood of a tractor and says, "We're going to take this bioluminescent livestock operation public, and we're going to make $1 billion. I just need you to find the investors. What do you do? Because if you're a registered rep, you are suddenly standing in a minefield of federal securities regulations." So welcome to the deep dive.
It is a terrifying minefield, honestly. And one wrong step means you lose your entire career.
Exactly. But before we get into the weeds of how to navigate that, I gotta say this deep dive is brought to you by Surf Fuel. They got a full series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at surffuel.com. Okay, let's unpack this because our mission today is very specific.
Right, we're not just going to hand you a cheat sheet to memorize.
No, memorization is incredibly fragile. When you are sitting in that testing center staring down the Series 82, you know, you're sleep deprived, the clock is ticking, the font on the screen is weird, rote memory just evaporates. Mm-hmm. We want to deeply wire this material into your brain.
And we are going to use ridiculous stories, vivid scenarios, and, well, a healthy dose of chaos so that you can easily recall these concepts under intense pressure.
Because that is the only way to truly learn this material.
Totally. To do that, we are introducing a framework we like to call the Series 82 Cinematic Universe. We are going to anchor all of these notoriously dry, dense, and, you know, highly technical regulatory concepts to three recurring characters.
If you can understand how the federal rules apply to this specific trio, you can answer literally any question Fun and Rye throws at you. So first up, we have Sam, the sponsor.
Right. Sam is our issuer.
He is the guy in the barn. He's running a highly questionable, arguably borderline insane startup trying to breed and sell those glow-in-the-dark alpacas. And because research and development for glowing livestock is expensive, well, Sam constantly needs cash.
Glow-in-the-dark alpacas, yeah. Naturally. I mean, the supply chain logistics alone are a nightmare.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
But who is going to help Sam get that cash? That brings us to our second character, Riley the Rep. Riley is a well-meaning, slightly frantic registered representative at a broker-dealer.
He's trying his absolute best to do his job, but he is constantly sweating through his shirt.
Yeah, because he knows he is always just one tiny misplaced signature or one bad email away from a catastrophic Fun and Rye violation that will just end his career.
And finally, we have Ingrid the investor.
Ingrid.
Ingrid is our buyer. She's mm-hmm. eccentric, she's wildly wealthy, and she is actively looking to throw her immense piles of cash at weird, high-risk alternative investments.
She is the exact target audience for Sam's bioluminescent farm animals. I love it.
Yeah.
So we are going to follow the entire life cycle of Sam's alpaca offering. We're going to watch Sam try to drum up business. We'll watch Riley try to find investors like Ingrid without breaking federal law. We'll open the accounts, make the recommendations, and eventually deal with the inevitable disastrous fallout when the alpacas stop glowing.
It is going to be a total mess.
A beautiful, testable mess. Let's jump right into the very beginning of the process. Pitching the business. Riley needs to tell people about these alpacas, but he can't just, you know, jump on a megaphone.
No, absolutely not.
Because half the battle on the Series 82, and I mean literally about 50% of the exam weight, mm-hmm. is just how you communicate with the public and seek business.
Right, because communication in the securities industry is strictly, ruthlessly categorized. Let's say Riley sits down at his desk and drafts an email about Sam's alpacas. "Hey, look at these glowing animals, great investment opportunity." He can't just hit send all to his entire contact list. The rules split communications into three distinct buckets. And those buckets are based entirely on the audience's size and the audience's makeup. First, we have what is called correspondence. This is defined as any written or electronic communication sent to 25 or fewer retail investors within any 30-day rolling period.
Okay, let me pause you there and really dig into this because this is foundational. 25 or fewer retail investors. And it's a rolling 30-day period, meaning it's not just the calendar month of April.
Right. It's any 30-day window.
You send 15 emails on April 20th and 15 on May 10th. You just broke the limit because that's 30 emails within a 30-day window.
Yeah.
But here's where I always get tripped up and where I want to push back on the regulatory logic. Why 25?
It's an arbitrary feeling number, I know.
Yeah. Like, why does the 26th person suddenly change the fabric of the universe? Why does emailing 25 people require almost no oversight? but the 26th person requires a registered Printthings to physically sign off on the email before Riley can hit send?
It is a great question, and to understand the why, you have to think about the potential blast radius of a lie. Regulators, specifically FINRA, they understand that a registered rep needs to email a handful of clients just to do their day-to-day job.
Right, like, hey, checking in.
Exactly. Here's an update on your account. Here's a thought on a new deal. If a branch manager or a supervisor had to pre-approve every single one of those one-off emails sent to 5 or 10 people, well, the entire financial industry would grind to a halt by noon.
Yeah, it's functionally impossible.
That's why correspondence, which is 25 or fewer retail investors, does not require pre-approval. It just needs post-use review or spot checking. But once you hit 26 retail investors, you cross a psychological and regulatory threshold. You are no longer having conversation with individuals. You are broadcasting a marketing message to a crowd.
You're standing on a soapbox.
Exactly. That is now classified as a retail communication. The regulatory logic is that supervision must scale with the potential damage. A misleading, fraudulent email about growing alpacas sent to 10 retail investors is bad, but it's contained.
Right. A misleading email sent to 500 retail investors is a massive crisis that destroys life savings. So for a retail communication, which is defined as being sent to more than 25 retail investors in a 30-day period, a registered principal must review and approve it before its earlier use or filing with FINRA. The principal has to stop the bomb from going off before the email leaves the building.
That makes total sense. Correspondence is a conversation. Retail communication is a broadcast. So correspondence is 25 or fewer retail. Retail communication is more than 25 retail. What's a third bucket? Because there's always a third bucket in these rules.
There is always a third bucket. It's institutional communication. This is written or electronic communication distributed or made available only to institutional investors. No retail eyes allowed. If even one retail investor is CC'd on the email, the whole thing loses its institutional status.
Why does it matter if just one retail investor sees it?
Because the regulations presume that institutional investors, like banks, massive hedge funds, insurance companies, they are financially sophisticated. They have teams of lawyers and analysts. They don't need the SEC or FINRA to hold their hands. Because of that presumed sophistication, institutional communication, just like correspondence, does not require pre-approval by a principal.
Ah, okay.
It just runs on the firm's written supervisory procedures, which usually just means a manager spot checks it later.
Okay, exam trap. I'm breaking the fourth wall here, listener, because this is where the test writers are going to try to ruin your day. They know you understand the three buckets, so they will try to trick you. With exceptions regarding private offerings.
Oh, they love this trick.
They will give you a scenario where Riley is selling Sam's private alpaca stock, and the question will say, hey, this is a private offering, so it's excluded from filing with FINRA, therefore. And then they give you a bunch of wrong answers about what Riley's allowed to do.
Yes, that is a classic, brutal trap. Mm. The exemption from filing is incredibly confusing for people. Just because a private offering communication is excluded from the FINRA filing requirement, meaning you don't have to literally mail a copy to FINRA's advertising department.
Right.
That absolutely does not mean it is excluded from the core content standards.
Right. You can't just lie because it's a private deal.
Precisely. Your communication, whether it goes to FINRA or not, still cannot be misleading. It still has to be fair and balanced. It still cannot contain exaggerated claims. And crucially, it is never, ever excluded from the three-year retention rule.
The three-year retention rule, this is huge. Let's unpack the mechanics of that. This means Riley's broker-dealer has to keep a copy of these alpaca emails for 3 years. But it's not just throwing them in a dusty box in a warehouse, right? For the first 2 years, they must be easily accessible.
Right. Easily accessible means if FINRA walks into the branch office for a surprise audit and says, show me every email Riley sent about alpacas, you can't tell them to wait 3 weeks while you pull tapes from an offsite bunker. You need to be able to produce them almost immediately.
Wow.
Filing and record keeping are two completely different beasts. You might not have to affirmatively send the marketing material to FINRA for approval, but you better believe you have to keep a pristine copy in your own files in case FINRA comes knocking.
Okay. You, listening right now, pause what you're doing.
Yeah.
I want you to think about this next scenario, because this tests exactly how well you've wired this concept. Let's say Riley drafts a pitch for Sam's Alpacas. He emails it out. He sends it to 20 retail investors. And in that exact same email blast, he sends it to 10 massive institutional investors. What kind of communication is this? Think about it for a second. 20 retail, 10 institutional. What bucket does it fall into? Got your answer. Let's break it down. Mm-hmm. Expert, tell them why their instinct might be wrong here.
Well, a lot of people hear 30 people total and immediately think, ah, that's more than 25. It must be a retail communication. It needs principal pre-approval. But that is wrong. It is correspondence.
Boom. Correspondence. Why?
Because the institutions do not count toward that 25 retail investor limit. The rule is 25 or fewer retail investors. 20 is less than 25. The 10 institutions are completely invisible to that specific metric. You could send it to 20 retail investors and 1,000 institutions, and it is still categorized as correspondence.
I love that. The institutions are just floating in the void. They don't trigger the alarm. This is exactly the kind of nuance you need to carry into the exam room. The test will try to blend the audiences to see if you remember what actually triggers the threshold.
Exactly. You must isolate the retail number.
All right. So Sam has figured out how Riley is going to communicate, but now we have to deal with the actual product. How does Sam legally sell shares in a glowing alpaca farm without going to federal prison? That brings us to part two, the rules of the game. We're talking the Securities Act of 1933 and Regulation D. Let's lay out the framework of how a standard public offering actually works first, just so we know what Sam is trying to avoid.
It's really important context. The Securities Act of 1933 is the granddaddy of them all. It is built on two pillars, registration and full disclosure. The government stance is, look, we aren't going to tell you if a glowing alpaca farm is a good or bad investment, but we are going to force you to tell the public every single terrifying detail about it before they buy.
Right. Let the buyer decide.
Exactly. To do that, the act splits an offering into three distinct chronological phases.
The timeline. Walk us through it.
First is the pre-filing period. Sam and his lawyers are locked in a room drafting the massive registration statement. During this period, there is an absolute blackout. No offers and no sales are allowed. You can't even hype it up. You can't go on a podcast and say, hey, we've got a really exciting livestock deal coming soon.
That's gun jumping, right?
Yes, that is called gun jumping, and the SEC will penalize you heavily for it.
Absolute silence. Got it.
Second, the issuer finally takes that massive document and files the registration statement with the SEC. Now you transition into the filed or cooling off period. This legally must last at least 20 days. During this time, the SEC is reviewing the document. For Riley the rep, the rules loosen slightly, but it's a very specific kind of loose.
How loose?
You can make oral offers, you can call Ingrid and say, hey, this alpaca thing is coming down the pipe, and you can distribute a preliminary prospectus, which is famously known in the industry as a red herring.
Okay, why is it called a red herring?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those terms the industry throws around, but nobody ever explains it to the new guy.
It's called a red herring because historically it had a massive disclaimer printed on the front cover in bright red ink. That disclaimer essentially said, this document is not complete, the SEC hasn't approved it yet, and the securities may not actually be sold. It's a warning.
Oh.
Because during this cooling off period, while you can distribute that red herring to gauge interest, you still absolutely cannot make any actual sales or accept any money.
So it's window shopping. Look, talk. Distribute the red ink warning document, but do not touch the cash.
Precisely. Finally, we reach the third phase. The SEC finishes their review and declares the registration effective. Now, and only now, can you actually execute sales and collect checks, provided that the buyer receives the final complete prospectus no later than the confirmation of the sale.
Okay, so that is the three-step dance for a fully registered public offering. Silence, then window shopping, then the grand opening. But Sam, the sponsor, looks at that process and laughs. He doesn't want to do a full SEC registration. It takes months, sometimes years. It costs a fortune in legal and accounting fees.
Yeah.
And frankly, I don't think the SEC is going to look too kindly on the audited financials of a bioluminescent barn.
Probably not.
He wants to skip the line. He wants an exemption. And here's where we need to make a massive fundamental distinction for the listener.
Hmm.
The difference between an exempt security and an exempt transaction.
This is critical. The exam will aggressively test your ability to separate the two.
Here's how I finally got my brain to understand it. Think of an exempt security as a diplomat with permanent, lifelong diplomatic immunity. U.S. government bonds, municipal bonds, bonds issued by banks. These are exempt securities. They're permanently immune from SEC registration. It does not matter who buys them. It doesn't matter who sells them. They are immune forever.
That's a fantastic analogy. The exemption is baked into the DNA of the security itself.
Right. But an exempt transaction, which is exactly what Sam is trying to pull off with a private placement, is totally different. An exempt transaction is not permanent immunity. It is like getting a one-time temporary hall pass from the principal's office. Sam gets a hall pass to walk down the hall, and sell these specific shares to Ingrid without registering them.
Yep.
But that immunity does not attach to the stock itself. When Ingrid receives that alpaca stock, she is holding what is called a restricted security. The hall pass expired the moment the transaction finished. She can't just turn around and sell that stock on the open market the next day. Her resale has to find its very own brand new exemption, or the security has to be fully registered.
And this concept is the key to unlocking one of the trickiest questions on the exam. This explains exactly why an issuer's public reporting status doesn't magically or automatically register the investor's private resales.
Wait, walk me through that.
Let's say a miracle happens. Sam Shoram takes off, and 2 years from now, he takes the company public, he does an IPO, and he starts filing quarterly 10Q reports with the SEC. People on the street can buy alpaca stock.
Good for Sam. But what about Ingrid? She bought in during the private, unregistered hall pass transaction 2 years ago.
Exactly. Even though the company is now public, Ingrid-specific shares are still legally restricted. They came from that original exempt transaction. She cannot just call her broker and say, dump my shares on the market. She still has to jump through the proper regulatory hoops, usually Rule 144, to legally lift that restriction before she can sell. The company's status didn't wash her shares clean automatically.
That hall pass analogy saves me every time. Okay, but let's talk about the dark side. What happens if Riley messes this up? What if Riley gets impatient, doesn't want to deal with the exemptions, and just sells unregistered, non-exempt securities to Ingrid? What is the penalty?
The penalty is brutal, and it's called rescission. If you sell a security in violation of Section 5 of the Securities Act, meaning no registration and no valid exemption, the investor has a right of rescission. This means Ingrid can legally force Riley and his firm to buy the security back from her at the original purchase price, plus interest.
Wow, they essentially have to rewind time and unwind the trade.
Yes, they have to make her whole like it never happened. And here is the terrifying kicker for Riley. There's absolutely no reasonable care defense for a registration violation.
Wait, really? What if Riley says, Your Honor, I tried really, really hard to follow the rules. I read the manual. I asked my manager. It was an honest paperwork error.
The judge will not care. Selling unregistered securities without an exemption is a strict liability offense. If you did it, you are liable. Full stop. There is no defense of, I tried my best.
Boom. Unwind the trade. Strict liability. But let me challenge that. What if the registration was valid? What if they used the hall pass correctly, but Riley just completely lied about the product? What if he made a material misstatement to Ingrid and said, oh yeah, the alpacas run on solar power. They are 100% self-sustaining.
Well, now you are dealing with a completely separate section of the law. That is liability under the anti-fraud provisions, not the registration provisions. And interestingly, the law treats fraud slightly differently when it comes to the burden of proof. For a material misstatement, a lie, or a massive omission, there actually is a reasonable care defense available for the broker dealer.
How does that work? How do you defend a lie?
Riley would have to prove to a court that he conducted thorough, exhaustive due diligence and was genuinely, reasonably deceived by Sam, the sponsor. He has to prove, I acted completely reasonably, I checked the facts, I looked at the farm, and Sam orchestrated an elaborate fraud that any reasonable person would have fallen for. If he can prove that, he might escape liability. But remember, for a pure registration violation, no defense.
That is a massive distinction. Registration violation equals strict liability. Fraud violation equals a possible reasonable care defense, but only if you actually did your homework. Okay, so Sam knows the stakes. He wants his one-time hall pass. He wants to do a Regulation D private placement. Reg D is the holy grail of private offerings. It is the engine that drives venture capital, private equity, and apparently glowing livestock. Let's break it down into its component parts, because the exam is going to test every millimeter of this rule.
First, we have to establish the absolute ironclad, never-to-be-broken rule of Reg D. Regulation D only exempts the issuer from registration. It never, ever, under any circumstances, exempts anyone from anti-fraud liability.
Shocker. The SEC still frowns on you lying to people, even in private.
Exactly. You are excused from the paperwork. You are not excused from the truth. Now, under Reg D, we have to look at the types of investors you are allowed to sell to. The rules treat wealthy, sophisticated investors very differently from your average retail investor. If you are selling to what the SEC calls accredited investors, you know, the wealthy elite, your sales are unlimited. You can sell to 10,000 accredited investors if you want and raise billions of dollars.
The sky is the limit.
But if you sell to non-accredited investors, everyday people, you are strictly capped. You can only sell to a maximum of 35 non-accredited investors in any 90 calendar day period. And even then, those non-accredited investors must be deemed sophisticated, meaning they have the knowledge and experience to evaluate the risks either on their own or with a purchaser representative.
So 35 is the magic number for regular folks.
Right.
And what about the paperwork? Sam still has to tell the SEC he's doing this, right?
Yes. Sam has to file a document called Form D with the SEC. And the timeline here is highly testable. Form D is due 15 calendar days after the first sale.
15 calendar days, not business days, calendar days. Now let's do a direct comparison because RegD has two very distinct flavors that students always get mixed up, Rule 506B and Rule 506C. I want to focus specifically on how advertising works in each of these because that is where Riley is going to get into trouble.
This is a crucial distinction. Let's start with the traditional route, Rule 506B. This is what we call the no solicitation exemption. Under 506B, you can raise an unlimited amount of money, and you are allowed to have up to those 35 non-accredited investors we just talked about. But here is the massive trade-off. You are absolutely, unequivocally banned from general solicitation or general advertising.
So Riley can just put up a billboard on the interstate that says, invest in alpacas.
No billboards, no mass emails to strangers, no website ads, no cold calling from a purchase list. To pitch a 506B deal, you must have a pre-existing substantive relationship with the investor before the offering even began. You have to actually know them and understand their financial situation.
Okay, so 506B is quiet. It's behind closed doors. But what if Sam says, I don't care. I want to scream from the rooftops. I want to buy a Super Bowl ad for these alpacas. Can he do it?
Yes. But he has to switch to Rule 506C. This is the newer accredited-only exemption. Under 506C, the SEC essentially says, fine, go crazy. You are permitted to advertise. You can put up that billboard. You can tweet about it. You can run the Super Bowl ad. But the trade-off here is incredibly severe. Every single purchaser in a 506C offering must be a verified accredited investor. You cannot have a single non-accredited investor. Zero, not even one.
Wait, so if Riley runs the ad and my grandmother calls him up and wants to invest, he has to turn her away?
If she isn't accredited, yes. And it goes further than that. The issuer, or Riley acting on their behalf, must take reasonable steps to verify that every purchaser is actually accredited.
What does that mean in the real world? How do you verify it?
Well, in the old 506B days, you could just have the investor check a box on a questionnaire that said, yes, I am a millionaire, and as long as you didn't have reason to doubt them, you were fine. Not in 506C. In an advertised deal, checking a box is not enough. Riley has to ask Ingrid to provide actual proof. He needs to see her W-2s, her tax returns, her bank statements, credit reports, or he needs a formal signed letter from her CPA or attorney confirming her status.
That sounds like an incredibly awkward conversation. Hey, Ingrid, thanks for wanting to invest $2 million with me. Now, please send me your last 2 years of tax returns so I can prove you aren't lying.
It is incredibly awkward, and a lot of investors hate it. They feel it's invasive, but it is the mandatory price you pay for the privilege of advertising a private placement.
Wow. Okay, so 506B is quiet, but allows a few non-accredited folks. 506C is loud, but demands invasive proof that everyone is rich. This brings us perfectly to part three. Who has the cash? We keep throwing around this magical term, accredited investor. It is the golden ticket. Riley desperately needs to figure out if Ingrid actually qualifies. Because if she doesn't, she either eats into his precious 35-person cap in a 506B deal, or she completely disqualifies a 506C advertised deal entirely. Let's define the whales. What exactly makes someone accredited?
Let's break down the three main tiers of wealth qualification in the securities world. It's like a VIP club with three different levels of access. Accredited investor, qualified institutional buyer, and qualified purchaser. We'll start at the bottom of the VIP list with the accredited investor. For a natural person, you know, a human being like Ingrid, there are two main ways to qualify, net worth or income. Let's look at net worth first. She needs an individual or joint net worth of over $1 million. But here is the critical, heavily tested part. That $1 million calculation must explicitly exclude the value of her primary residence.
Okay, let's test this right now. You, listening on your commute or at your desk, I want you to calculate this in your head. Ingrid has a total net worth of $2 million. She looks great on paper, but Ingrid loves real estate. $1.5 million of that net worth is just the built-up equity in her massive, sprawling primary mansion where she lives. The rest is in stocks and cash. Is Ingrid an accredited investor based on her net worth? Think about the math. Expert, give them the bad news.
The answer is no. She is not accredited based on net worth. You have to subtract the positive equity of the primary residence. So you take her $2 million total net worth, you subtract the $1.5 million from the house, and her qualifying net worth is only $500,000. she falls short of the 1 million mark.
But why? Why does the SEC hate houses? Why doesn't that money count? It's her money.
Because the SEC wants to ensure that if this high-risk private placement goes to zero, if the alpacas all die, the investor isn't going to end up homeless. The primary residence is a heavily illiquid asset, and its value is subjective and volatile. You can't easily sell your living room to cover a margin call. The SEC wants to see $1 million in other assets, proving you have a true cushion to absorb a massive loss without destroying your life.
That makes a terrifying amount of sense.
Okay.
But Riley isn't out of luck yet. What if Ingrid didn't hit the net worth test, but she makes a ton of cash every year? What is the income test?
The income test is straightforward. If she has an annual income of over $200,000 in each of the last two most recent years, and she has a reasonable expectation of reaching the same income level this current year, she is accredited as an individual. If she is married and they want to qualify based on joint income, that threshold jumps to $300,000.
Over $200,000 for 2 years, plus current year expectations.
Okay.
Are there any other ways for a human being to be accredited without being a millionaire? Like, what if you're just really smart about finance?
Yes. FINRA and the SEC recently added a carve-out for industry professionals. It's an acknowledgement that wealth isn't the only measure of sophistication. If you hold certain designated professional licenses in good standing, specifically the Series 7, the Series 65, or the Series A2, you are automatically considered an accredited investor, regardless of your bank account balance. You are deemed financially sophisticated by virtue of passing the rigorous exams.
Hold on. So by studying for this very test, by listening to this deep dive, the listener is literally trying to legally become an accredited investor.
That is exactly right. Passing the 82 gets you into the club.
That is a fun twist. Use that as motivation. Okay, what about entities? What if Ingrid wants to invest through her LLC or a trust?
For entities like a trust, a corporation, or a partnership, the general threshold is they must have over $5 million in total assets, and crucially, they cannot have been formed specifically for the purpose of buying this one exact security.
No cheating.
Right. Alternatively, there is a look-through rule. If it's an entity where every single equity owner is an accredited investor individually, the entity itself inherits that accredited status, regardless of its total assets.
Okay, so that is level one of the VIP club. Accredited equals rich. What's the next tier up?
The next tier is the QIB, the Qualified Institutional Buyer. This is a much, much higher bar. First of all, a QIB must be an institution. It can never be a human being, no matter how rich they are. A QIB must be an institution that owns and invests on a discretionary basis at least $100 million in unaffiliated securities.
$100 million.
Yeah.
That is mega rich institution territory. We are talking major pension funds, insurance companies. Wait, what if the institution is a broker-dealer, like Riley's firm?
If the institution is a registered broker-dealer, the threshold drops significantly to $10 million in securities owned and invested.
Okay, so why do we hear about QIBs? What special privilege do they get for having $100 million?
QIBs operate in a special regulatory playground under a rule called Rule 144A. Remember how we talked about restricted stock, how Ingrid gets that hall pass stock and is stuck with it?
Right.
Well, Rule 144A allows QIBs to buy restricted, unregistered securities from one another in the secondary market without any holding periods. So if a QIB buys restricted alpaca stock today, they don't have to wait 6 months or a year to sell it. They can sell it tomorrow, but only to another QIB.
So it's a walled garden.
Exactly. The security stays restricted to the general public. It can never leak out to retail investors, but it trades freely and instantly within this walled garden of mega institutions. It creates a massive, liquid, private secondary market just for the titans of Wall Street.
A walled garden for the mega rich.
Yeah, got it.
And what is the absolute highest tier, the final boss of investor qualification?
That is the qualified purchaser, or QP. For an individual human being to be a QP, it requires $5 million in investments. For an institution to be a QP, it requires $25 million in investments.
Okay, why do we care about QPs? What superpower do they have that a regular accredited investor doesn't?
They are the limit breakers for private hedge funds. Under the Investment Company Act of 1940, a private fund usually has to strictly cap its investors at 100 people. If they go over 100, they are forced to register with the SEC as a heavily regulated mutual fund, which ruins their high-risk strategy.
Oh, wow.
But there is an exemption under Section 3C7 of that act. If a private fund restricts its investors exclusively to qualified purchasers, that 100-person cap completely disappears. They can have an unlimited number of investors, 1,000, 5,000, as long as every single one of them is a QP.
Okay, that is a ton of definitions. We need a repetition cycle to lock this in. Listener, hear this. I'm going to distill this down to the caveman terms so you can't forget it on test day. Accredited investor equals rich. 1 million net worth without the house or 200K income. Or you pass the Series 82. QIB equals mega rich institution. 100 million in securities. They can trade restricted stock with each other immediately in their walled garden. QP equals super rich limit breaker. 5 million for individuals. They let hedge funds totally ignore the 100 investor cap.
That is a perfect summary. Print that on a flashcard. Now, what if Sam wants to raise money, but he doesn't want to deal with the strict wealth requirements of Reg D? What if he wants to take small amounts of money from regular non-accredited people, but he still doesn't want to do a full IPO? What are his other options?
This brings us to part 4. Alternative escape routes. Let's look at Regulation A, Regulation S, and the interest rate exemption. Let's start with Reg A. I always like to think of Reg A as Kickstarter for equity. It is designed for smaller, early-stage companies that want to raise money from the general public, including your average, unaccredited retail investors, but without the soul-crushing burden of a full SEC IPO.
Kickstarter for equity is a great way to frame it. Regulation A is technically an exemption, but it's often called a mini-IPO or a qualified public offering because it still requires an offering circular to be filed and approved by the SEC. Reg A is split into two distinct tiers, and you need to know the limits of both. Tier 1 allows an issuer to raise up to $20 million in any 12-month period.
$20 million is a solid chunk of change for a farm. What is the catch with Tier 1?
The catch is state regulators. Under Tier 1, even though you get federal clearance, you still have to register the offering at the state level, meaning you have to deal with the state securities administrators, the blue sky laws, in every single state you want to sell in. If you want to sell in 15 states, you have to get approval from 15 different state regulators, and they can all demand different things. It can be a nightmare. When the offering is finally done, you file a simple exit report with the SEC, and you're mostly done with them.
Okay, dealing with 50 different state regulators sounds horrible. Sam definitely doesn't want to do that. What about Tier 2?
Tier 2 is the much bigger brother. Under Tier 2, you can raise up to $75 million per 12-month period. And the massive game-changing advantage of Tier 2 is that it preempts state registration.
Preempts, meaning it overrules them.
Yes. Federal law steps in and says to the states, we handled this, back off. You don't have to get approval from 50 different state regulators based on the merits of your business. You still have to do a simple notice filing and pay the state their fees. They always want their money, but they cannot block the deal just because they think glowing alpacas are a bad idea.
That is huge.
Yeah.
But there has to be a trade-off. The SEC isn't just going to let you take $75 million from regular people without strings attached.
You are correct. Because Tier 2 preempts state regulators and allows you to raise so much more money from regular retail investors, the SEC imposes two big conditions to protect the public. First, non-accredited investors are capped in how much they can legally buy. They cannot invest more than 10% of their annual income or 10% of their net worth, whichever number is greater. So they can only risk a fraction of their wealth.
A built-in safety net. What's the second condition?
The second condition is ongoing transparency. The issuer has to act a bit more like a real public company. Sam would have to file ongoing reports with the SEC, specifically annual reports, semi-annual reports, and current reports for major events. Tier 1 doesn't have those ongoing reporting requirements.
So Tier 1 is smaller money, deal with the states, but no ongoing reports. Tier 2 is big money, ignore the states, but you have to file reports forever and cap the little guy.
Got it. Okay, let's pivot. What if Sam looks at the American regulatory system and says, forget America, the SEC is too strict. I want to sell these alpacas exclusively to wealthy Europeans.
Then he's looking at Regulation S. Reg S is the exemption for offshore transactions. The core rule here is incredibly strict about geography. The transaction must occur outside the United States, and the issuer, along with any broker-dealers involved, is absolutely forbidden from engaging in any directed selling efforts within the U.S.
Directed selling efforts, meaning marketing. You can't run ads in the Wall Street Journal promoting your European offering. You can't hold a seminar in New York for a London-based deal. Exactly. You cannot condition the U.S. market. The SEC says, if you want the offshore exemption, keep the entire thing offshore.
And do these securities stay offshore forever? What if an American wants to buy them later?
They don't stay offshore forever. They have what is called a distribution compliance period, which is basically a mandatory holding period where the securities absolutely cannot be resold to U.S. persons. Depending on the type of security, debt versus equity, and the reporting status of the company, that compliance period ranges from no holding period at all for certain high-quality foreign debt up to one full year for non-reporting equity.
Okay, last escape route, the interstate exemption. Rule 147. Sam gets homesick. He says, I don't want to go to Europe. I just want to keep it local. I only want to sell to people right here in my home state of Colorado.
If he wants to use the interstate exemption, Rule 147, he is confined strictly to the borders of that single state. And the rules to prove you are a local company are rigid. First, the issuer must be a resident of the state, meaning they are incorporated there and have their principal place of business there. Second, they have to pass one of the 80% doing business tests.
What does that mean? How do you prove you are 80% doing business?
You only have to pass one of these, but they are tough. Either 80% of your gross revenues must come from operations within the state, or 80% of your assets must be physically located in the state, or 80% of the net proceeds from the offering must be used within the state. Alternatively, a majority of your employees must be based in the state.
And if you pass that test, who can buy the stock?
Only verified residents of that exact state. 100% of the offers and sales must be to in-state residents. And this is a zero-tolerance policy. If Riley accidentally sells just one single share to a guy who lives 10 feet across the border in Wyoming, the entire federal exemption is blown for the whole offering. The SEC steps in and says, you just conducted an unregistered interstate offering.
Wow. One mistake ruins the whole deal. And if the Colorado investor wants to sell their shares to their cousin in Wyoming,
they have to wait. There is a mandatory 6-month resale limit. For 6 months after the initial purchase, the securities can only be resold to other residents of that same state. After 6 months, they are free to be sold out of state.
Okay, we have our exemptions. Let's move to part 5. Making the sausage. We need to talk about the mechanics of the deal, handling the massive amounts of money, and the vital concept of due diligence. Let's start with how the deal actually gets distributed. Riley Assurum is acting as the placement agent or the underwriter. But here is the multi-million dollar question. Who takes the hit if nobody wants to buy these alpacas?
That depends entirely on the specific language of the underwriting agreement. Distribution methods fundamentally split the risk of an unsold offering between the agent, Riley's firm, and the issuer, Sam. Let's look at the scenario where the agent takes the risk. This happens in what is called a firm commitment underwriting.
Firm commitment, the name kind of gives it away.
It does. In a firm commitment, Riley's broker-dealer actually acts as a principal. They buy the entire block of shares from Sam up front, putting their own capital on the line. Sam gets a massive check immediately, and Sam is happy. He walks away. Then Riley's firm turns around and tries to resell those shares to the public at a slightly higher price, the public offering price. The difference is their profit spread. But if the market rejects the glowing alpacas and they can't sell the shares, Riley's firm eats the loss. They now own a warehouse full of unsold alpaca stock.
I can guarantee you Riley's compliance department and chief risk officer are not letting him do a firm commitment on bioluminescent farm animals. They are not taking that risk. There is also a variation of this called a standby, right?
Yes, a standby underwriting is used in rights offerings. When a company issues new shares to existing shareholders, the underwriter stands by and promises to purchase whatever shares the current shareholders don't want. Again, the firm is putting its own capital at risk to guarantee the issuer gets their money. In both firm commitment and standby, it is agent risk.
So what are the other options? The options where Riley's firm doesn't bet their own money, where the issuer takes the risk.
Those are called contingency offerings. The most common is a best efforts agreement. In this scenario, Riley's firm acts merely as an agent, not a principal. They promise Sam, we will try our absolute best to sell these shares. We will market them aggressively. But if Sam wanted to raise $10 million and Riley's firm only manages to sell $5 million worth, that's all Sam gets. The firm has absolutely no financial liability for the unsold shares. The risk is entirely on Sam falling short of his goal.
And there are specific variations of the best efforts deal that the exam loves to test, right? Like all or none.
Yes. In an all or none offering, the contingency is absolute. The deal only happens, and the company only gets the money if 100% of the shares are sold. If they sell 99.9%, the deal is canceled, the contingency fails, and all the investors get their money back. Then there is the mini-max offering. This is a hybrid. There is a minimum threshold that must be met for the deal to close. Say they must raise at least $5 million. If they hit $4.9 million, it's canceled. But once they hit that $5 million minimum, the contingency is satisfied, the escrow breaks, and they can keep selling up to a maximum cap, say $10 million.
Okay, this brings up a massive logistical and regulatory issue. Handling the money. Let's role play this. We are in a mini max offering. The minimum is $5 million. Riley starts calling people. Ingrid says yes, and she writes a check for $1 million. Riley has a $1 million check in his hand, but the deal isn't officially closed yet because they haven't hit the $5 million threshold. Riley can't just put Mingard's check in his desk drawer, right? He can't cash it into his firm's operating account. He certainly can't give it to Sam yet, because what if they never hit the 5 million? Sam will just spend it on alpaca food.
Absolutely not. Do not put checks in a desk drawer. This is a heavily tested area regarding customer protection. Under SEC Rule 15C24, contingency money must be fiercely protected. The broker-dealer has to promptly deposit those funds into a separate dedicated bank account, or more commonly for these types of high-dollar private placements, a written bank escrow account managed by a third-party unaffiliated bank.
It has to be locked away.
Yes. The money sits in that escrow account, completely untouchable by the issuer and untouchable by the broker-dealer, until the contingency resolves. If the deal successfully hits the 5 million minimum threshold, the escrow agent is authorized to release the funds to Sam. If the deal fails to hit the minimum by the specified deadline, the escrow agent returns the money directly to the investors. It prevents fraud, and it prevents the broker-dealer from using client funds to float their own operations.
Okay, so the money is locked up. Before Riley even starts collecting checks, his firm has to do something incredibly important: due diligence, a reasonable investigation. And this is crucial for the listener to grasp. Why? Because as we established earlier, Reg D exempts you from registration. It does not exempt you from fraud.
Right. When a broker-dealer agrees to act as an agent and recommends a private placement to a client, they are functionally vouching for it. They owe a duty to their clients to conduct their own reasonable, independent investigation into the issuer, the business plan, and the claims being made. The depth of that investigation must be sized to the complexity and risk of the deal.
And FINRA is very, very clear in their regulatory notices about what does not excuse this duty. Let's break some myths. First myth: my clients are billionaires, they can figure it out.
False. Having a highly sophisticated customer base, even a roster of QIBs or QPs, does not end the broker-dealer's inquiry. You cannot abdicate your duty just because your client is smart or rich.
Second myth: the company gave me audited financials from a big accounting firm, so I don't need to look any closer.
False again. The presence of an audit is helpful, but it does not end the inquiry. Audits look at past numbers. They don't assess the viability of the forward-looking business model or the character of the management team.
Let me give you an analogy to really cement how deep this duty goes. Let's say Sam states in his offering memorandum that the alpacas naturally glow because of a genetic mutation. That is the core value proposition. Riley goes out to the farm for a site visit. While he's walking through the barn, he looks in a trash can and sees a massive receipt from Home Depot for 500 cans of neon green glow-in-the-dark spray paint. That is a massive screaming red flag.
That is the literal definition of a red flag.
Riley cannot just go up to Sam and say, "Hey man, is this paint for the alpacas?" And accept Sam saying, "Oh no, that's to paint the barn roof so airplanes don't hit it." And Riley cannot just accept a legally drafted memo from Sam's outside counsel that says, "We have verified the animals are naturally bioluminescent."
Exactly. That is the core rule FINRA enforces. Red flags override management's word, they override the glossy offering document, and they override outside counsel's report. The broker-dealer has an affirmative duty to investigate that red flag independently until it is fully resolved. You have to ask to see the barn roof. You have to wash an alpaca.
Wash an alpaca, I love it. And what if Riley's firm is the one actually writing the offering memorandum? What if they are drafting the private placement memorandum, the PPM?
Drafting the offering document significantly raises the bar for the broker-dealer. If your firm is writing the document, you are expected to know exactly what is in it and independently verify the material claims. You can lean on outside counsel or a syndicate manager to do some of the heavy lifting, but that only shifts the work. It never, ever shifts the responsibility. The regulatory buck stops with the broker-dealer making the recommendation.
And how does Riley prove to FINRA that he washed the alpaca, that he did all this diligence?
Documentation. Only the written record proves the work was done. If it isn't documented in a due diligence file in the eyes of regulators, it simply didn't happen.
Great. Two quick mechanical points before we move on to opening the accounts. Filing and compensation.
Unless a private placement fits into a very narrow, specific list of exemptions, the FINRA member firm selling it must file the private placement offering documents with FINRA within 15 calendar days of the first sale. Note that this is a FINRA rule, which is completely separate from the Form D that Sam files with the SEC, though they share that 15-day timeline.
And what about paying people to find investors? Let's say Riley is struggling to find buyers for the alpacas. His buddy at the golf course says, "Hey, I know a ton of rich guys. I'll bring them to you. Just give me a 5% cut of their investment." Can Riley do that?
No, a vital rule regarding compensation in this industry, you cannot pay an unregistered person transaction-based compensation for bringing in securities business, period.
What if Riley tries to get cute? What if he says, I'm not paying you to the investors, I'm just paying you a marketing consulting fee that conveniently equals 5% of what they bring in?
FINRA is not stupid. They look at the economic substance of the arrangement, not the label you slap on it. You can call it a consulting fee, a finder's fee, or a referral bonus. If the payment is functionally tied to the success of bringing in securities business, it is prohibited to pay it to someone who doesn't hold a license. There is one very narrow, heavily restricted exception for non-registered foreign finders bringing in foreign customers under specific conditions, but domestically, it's a hard no.
All right, take a deep breath. Shake it out. We are shifting gears entirely. Welcome to part 6, bringing Ingrid on board. We are entering the paperwork zone. I want you to imagine a highly secure vault where every single document is scrutinized under an electron microscope. This section makes up 18% of your exam. Riley has convinced Ingrid to buy the alpacas. Now he has to actually open her brokerage account. What do we need to get this done?
To open a new account, the firm needs a minimum of 6 specific items on record for the customer. They need her legal name, her tax identification number, like a social security number, her physical address, and no PO boxes for the primary address, her date of birth, the name of the registered rep assigned to the account, and they must ask whether she is associated with another broker-dealer, which is a major compliance check.
That's the mandatory 6. Are there other things they should try to get?
Yes, there are 3 more pieces of information the firm must make a reasonable effort to obtain before the initial transaction settles. Her occupation and employer, her annual income, and her net worth. If she refuses to give those 3, you document the refusal, but you can still open the account. You cannot open it without the first 6.
But the golden rule here, the thing that trips people up on the exam every single time, is the signature rule. Mm. How does this account actually become an official, legally open account? Does Ingrid's signature open it? Does Riley's?
Neither. An account opens only upon the acceptance signature of a designated partner, officer, or manager at the firm, the principal.
So Riley fills out the form. Can he just call his branch manager who is on the golf course and get a verbal, yeah, Riley, I know Ingrid looks good, go ahead and open it?
Never. Never, ever a verbal sign-off. It must be a documented, physical, or electronic signature from the principal formally accepting the account on behalf of the firm. Only when that signature hits the page is the account truly open. Furthermore, if Ingrid later wants to change anything on her account profile, like updating her address because she moved, or changing her investment objective from growth to speculation, that change requires a brand new review and signature by a principal, plus documented confirmation sent to the customer.
Why do they have to notify the customer?
To prevent unauthorized tampering. If a rogue broker wants to put a conservative client into a highly speculative alpaca farm, they might try to secretly change the client's objective on the computer to justify the trade. By forcing the firm to send a confirmation of the change to the client's address, the client gets a letter saying, your objective was changed to speculation, and they can call the firm and scream, I didn't authorize that.
It's a tripwire for fraud. I love it. Okay, let's do a direct comparison on a concept that is universally tested, discretion. Ingrid is exhausted from all this paperwork. She is going on a silent, month-long yoga retreat in the Himalayas. She's going to have 0 cell service, but she wants Riley to actively trade her account while she's gone. There are 2 types of discretion we need to understand. Let's talk about time and price discretion first. I like to explain it this way. Time and price discretion is like telling a friend, hey, go to the cafe and buy me a black coffee when the line gets short.
That's a great setup. Break it down.
You, the customer, dictated the exact action, buy. You dictated the exact asset, a black coffee. They just get to pick when they step up to the counter and exactly how much they pay based on the line and the price at that specific moment.
That is precisely how it works in securities. For time and price discretion, the customer must specify the asset, the action, buy or sell, and the exact quantity. For example, Ingrid says, Riley, buy 100 shares of Apple. The rep is just choosing the time of day or the specific price to execute the order to get the best fill. Because the customer made the core investment decision, this does not require formal written discretionary approval from the customer or the firm.
But there is a time limit, right?
Yes, it is strictly temporary. Time and price discretion dies at the end of the business day. If Riley doesn't buy the Apple stock by the closing bell, the order expires.
So if the line never gets short, the friend doesn't buy the coffee, the order is dead. Now, compare that to full discretion. Full discretion is fundamentally different. It is like giving your friend your entire wallet and saying, hey, I'm hungry, buy me breakfast.
Exactly. They have total control. They decide if you get a coffee, a bagel, a fruit cup, or a share in a glowing alpaca farm.
Full discretion means the rep is deciding which security to buy or sell, or how much of it to trade. This entirely transfers the actual investment decision away from the customer and onto the rep. Because of that immense power, the rules are incredibly strict. What are the hurdles?
It requires three things. First, written authorization from the customer beforehand, a power of attorney. Second, written acceptance of that discretionary power by the firm's principal. And third, a principal must review and approve each individual order entered discretionarily in writing, typically on the exact same day it's entered, to ensure the broker isn't abusing the power.
You cannot just go rogue with someone's wallet. Okay, what about the customer investment profile? Riley needs to thoroughly know Ingrid's financial situation before he even thinks about pitching her the alpacas.
The investment profile is essentially a dossier. It includes 9 named facts that the rep must gather through reasonable diligence. Things like age, other investments she holds, her overall financial situation, her tax status, her specific investment objectives, and her liquidity needs. And here is a key exam point that tests your understanding of a broker's duty. A firm cannot use a waiver to disclaim this responsibility. You cannot have Ingrid sign a piece of paper saying, I legally absolve Riley of having to know my financial situation.
You can't contract your way out of knowing your client. Speaking of tax status, what is the default mechanic if a customer sells some shares but doesn't specify to the broker exactly which ones they're selling? Let's say Ingrid bought 100 shares of Apple at $50 and later bought another 100 shares at $150. Now she wants to sell 100 shares. Which ones did she sell?
If she doesn't specify at the time of the trade, the default tax mechanic used by the IRS is FIFO, first in, first out. The IRS assumes you sold the oldest shares you owned first. So she would be selling the $50 shares, which means a larger capital gain. And remember, for capital gains tax purposes, the definition of long-term means holding the asset for more than 1 year. Holding it for exactly 1 year to the day is still considered a short-term gain, which is taxed at a much higher rate.
More than 1 year. It's the little details that count. Let's talk about Form CRS, the Customer Relationship Summary. This is a relatively new, plain English disclosure document. When exactly does Ingrid get this?
Form CRS must be delivered to a retail investor at the earliest of 3 specific triggers. When a recommendation is made to them, when an order is placed for them, or when a new account is opened for them. Whichever of those 3 events happens first, that is when the Form CRS must be in their hands.
All right, the account is opened, the paperwork is filed. Now we move to part 7, making the pitch. This section is massive, making up 26% of the exam, recommendations and records. Riley is finally ready to sit down with Ingrid and tell her to buy the alpacas. We have a monumental direct comparison here between 2 distinct standards of care that dictate how Riley must act. Regulation best interest, Reg BI, versus the suitability rule.
This is arguably the most critical distinction in this entire section. If you get a question about a recommendation, you must identify the standard first, and you do that based entirely on who the customer is.
Okay, so let's start with Reg BI. Who is that for?
Reg BI is exclusively for retail customers. Customers who are natural persons using the investment for personal, family, or household purposes, like Ingrid. If you are recommending a security or an investment strategy or even an account type to a retail customer, Reg BI applies. It is a very high standard that runs on 4 core obligations: disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance.
Let's focus on the care obligation, because that's where the rubber meets the road. It means the recommendation must truly be in the customer's best interest, and the rep cannot put their own financial interests ahead of the customer's. But wait, I want to challenge this. Does best interest just mean the cheapest product? If I'm Riley and I have a choice between 2 mutual funds to recommend, do I legally have to pick the one with the lowest fee to satisfy Reg BI?
No, that is a very common misconception. Cost must always be weighed heavily, but the cheapest option isn't automatically the best interest. A slightly more expensive fund might have a significantly better track record, a more experienced management team, or specific features that perfectly align with the customer's complex goals. You have to consider the entire holistic picture of the investment, but you must be able to justify exactly why the extra cost is actually in their best interest.
Okay, so Reg BI is strictly for retail. What about the older standard, the suitability rule? Where does that apply?
Suitability applies everywhere else. Specifically to institutional accounts, non-retail entities, and situations where Reg BI doesn't legally reach. The suitability standard is a bit older and runs on 3 main obligations. First, reasonable basis suitability. Is this a sound, mathematically logical investment for anyone? Second, customer-specific suitability based on the profile. Is it sound for this specific customer? And third, quantitative suitability. Is the sheer volume of trading appropriate?
Quantitative suitability, that's a fancy way of talking about churning, right?
Yeah.
Generating excessive commissions by trading a client's account way too much.
Yes. Churning is a major violation. And here is a key exam point about churning. To actually prove a broker is guilty of churning, you have to prove two distinct elements. First, that the trading was objectively excessive and unsuitable for the client's goals. But second, you have to prove that the broker had control over the account, either formal discretionary control or de facto control, because the client trusts them implicitly, and that the broker acted with commission intent, meaning they executed the trades specifically to enrich themselves via fees at the customer's expense, disregarding the client's financial health.
Direct question for the listener. Pay close attention. Let's say Riley is dealing with a massive institutional client. Can an institutional account be covered by both Reg BI and the suitability rule at the exact same time? Think about it for a second. Can they overlap? Expert, give it to them.
Never both. They are mutually exclusive based on the customer type. You identify the standard first based on the customer. If they are a retail natural person, it is Reg BI. If they are an institutional entity, it is suitability. They do not overlap. And applying the wrong standard on the exam will lead you to the wrong answer.
Keep them separated. Okay, let's talk about the actual pitch. When Riley is sitting across from Ingrid, describing the portfolio risks of a speculative alpaca farm, what are the communication rules? Can he just pipe it up?
The overarching communication standard is that all product descriptions must be fair and balanced. This means if you state a benefit of an investment, you must simultaneously state the corresponding risk that could defeat that benefit. You cannot say these alpacas offer incredible unlimited upside potential without immediately adding, however, they are highly illiquid, highly speculative, and you could lose your entire principal investment. A material omission of a key risk breaks the standard and can trigger anti-fraud liability.
Let's run through some specific, highly testable portfolio risks. These are guaranteed to be on the exam. First, inflation risk.
Also known as purchasing power risk. This is the risk that inflation naturally erodes the constant dollar value of your investment over time. It primarily affects fixed income securities like long-term bonds. If you buy a bond that pays a fixed 3% a year, but the national inflation rate jumps to 5%, you are actively losing purchasing power every single year you hold that bond. Your money buys less.
Next, liquidity risk.
The risk that you simply won't be able to sell the asset quickly when you desperately need the cash. Private placements, like Sam's unregistered alpacas, have massive defining liquidity risk because there is no active public market for them. You are stuck with them until you find a private buyer.
Next, call risk. This one is tricky for a lot of people.
Call risk specifically applies to callable bonds. This is the risk that the issuer of the bond will call or retire the bond before it reaches its stated maturity date. And here is the golden rule you must memorize. Issuers call bonds when interest rates fall.
Why? I always explain it like refinancing a mortgage, because it's the exact same logic. Let's say you have a mortgage of 7%. If national interest rates drop to 4%, what do? You refinance. You pay off the 7% loan and take out a new cheaper one at 4% to save yourself money. The corporate issuer does the exact same thing. They call in your 7% bond, pay you off early, and issue new bonds to the public at 4%. It's a great financial move for them, but it is terrible for the investor who just lost that sweet 7% yield.
That is the perfect way to understand it. And that scenario leads directly into the next major risk, reinvestment risk. If your 7% bond is called away from you because rates fell, you are now sitting on a pile of cash. You have to reinvest that cash in the current market where rates are now much lower. You're forced to accept a lower yield. You can't get that 7% anymore.
So how does a smart investor protect against reinvestment risk?
A very common and highly testable strategy is called laddering. Instead of buying one massive bond that matures in 10 years, you buy a portfolio of smaller bonds with staggered, stepped maturity dates. Some mature in 1 year, some in 3 years, some in five, some in 10. This spreads out your reinvestment risk over a long horizon, so you aren't forced to reinvest your entire portfolio in a single, potentially low interest rate environment all at once.
Brilliant. Spreading the risk across time. Now let's talk about a very specific protection mechanism that brokers have. Temporary holds. Let's say Riley is looking at Ingrid's account. Ingrid is getting up there in years. Suddenly, someone claiming to be her new nephew tries to wire all of her money out of the account to an offshore bank. Riley suspects she's being financially exploited. What can he do?
Firms have the regulatory authority to place a permissive temporary hold on disbursements of funds or securities if they reasonably suspect financial exploitation of a specified adult, typically someone 65 or older, or someone with an impairment.
But they can't just freeze her money forever, right? What is the specific timeline on that hold?
The timeline is highly structured, and you need to know the days. If a firm places a hold, they have exactly 2 business days to formally notify all authorized parties on the account and the trusted contact person that the hold was placed.
2 days to notify. Then what?
The initial hold lasts for 15 business days. This gives the firm time to investigate the suspicious nephew. If the firm internal investigation supports the suspicion of fraud, they can extend the hold for another 10 business days, bringing the total to 25. And if a state regulator or a state agency gets involved in the investigation, they can mandate an extension for another 30 days, bringing the total potential hold to 55 business days. 2 to notify, then 15, extend it to 25, extend it to 55. Know those numbers.
2, 15, 25, 55.
Yeah.
Got it. Let's pivot to record keeping. How long does Riley's firm have to keep all of this mind-numbing paperwork?
Different records have different regulatory lifespans. The heavy hitters, the core financial documents, are ledgers, general ledgers, and customer ledgers. Those must be kept for 6 years. Order memoranda, which is the record of a trade order, regardless of whether it was actually executed or canceled, must be kept for 3 years. Customer account cards, all that profiling info we talked about, are kept for 6 years after the account is officially closed. And organizational records of the broker-dealer firm itself, like partnership articles or corporate charters, are kept for the life of the enterprise.
Okay, we are in the home stretch of this section, and we have to talk about Regulation FD. Fair disclosure, this is a massive concept. But first, let's clarify who it applies to. It applies to the issuer, not the rep. So this is Sam's problem, not Riley's problem.
Correct. Reg FD is a rule for public companies. It is designed to prevent selective disclosure, which is essentially legal insider trading. It dictates that if a public company issuer discloses material non-public information to certain privileged individuals, like Wall Street analysts, big hedge fund managers, or large institutional shareholders, they must disclose that exact same information to the general public. You cannot whisper secrets to the elite.
So let's look at 2 scenarios for Sam. Scenario 1. Sam's at a bar in New York. He's had a few too many drinks. He is sitting next to a hedge fund manager, and he accidentally blurts out, "Honestly, the alpacas don't actually glow. It's just a trick of the lighting in the barn." We're ruined. That is massive, material, non-public information. He leaked it unintentionally. What does RegFD require him to do?
Because the leak was unintentional, RegFD requires Sam to disclose that information to the public promptly. Promptly is defined as being as soon as reasonable or practicable, but in no event later than 24 hours, or the start of the next day's trading on the New York Stock Exchange. He has to put out a press release or file an 8K the next morning admitting the truth.
But what if it wasn't an accident? Scenario 2. Sam holds a private, closed-door boardroom meeting with his 5 biggest investors. He intentionally tells them the alpacas are a fraud so they can quietly sell their shares before the news hits the papers.
If the disclosure is intentional, the timeline changes completely. Reg FD dictates that the public disclosure must be simultaneous. He must release the news to the public on a wire service at the exact same moment he tells the insiders in that room. You cannot give your buddies a head start.
Which brings us, inevitably, to the final section of our saga, Part 8, the fallout. This is 6% of the exam. The alpacas are a bust. The neon green spray paint washed off in a rainstorm. The animals are just regular angry alpacas. Ingrid is furious.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the final transactions of the complaints. First, let's rewind to when Ingrid was buying in. When did the private placement transaction actually become official? Riley had her check, but when did she actually own the shares?
This is a mechanical point, but an important one. A private placement transaction is not ready to process, and it is not official, until the issuer accepts the subscription agreement. Riley collecting the money and getting Ingrid's signature on the paperwork is not enough to close the deal. Sam, as the issuer, has to physically sign the document accepting Ingrid as an investor in his company. Only when Sam signs it is it a done deal.
But now the deal has gone entirely south. Ingrid writes a furious 3-page letter to Riley's firm complaining about the fraud, the spray paint, and the fact that she lost $1 million. How is that written complaint handled from a regulatory standpoint?
FINRA rules require that a file of all written customer complaints be kept at each Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction, or OSJ, for 4 years.
Exam trap. I'm yelling it again because people miss this all the time. Exam trap right here. Listen closely to the wording. Where are the complaints kept and who keeps them?
The physical or electronic records are kept at the OSJ, but they are technically and legally maintained by the member firm, not the individual office itself. The test will try to trick you by asking whose responsibility it is to maintain the complaint file, and they will offer the OSJ as an answer. It is the firm's overarching responsibility, even though the storage location is the OSJ. And remember, the retention period for written complaints is 4 years.
Okay, a letter is one thing, but Ingrid doesn't stop there. She sues Riley. She claims he lied about the bioluminescence and failed his due diligence. Riley has a massive legal disaster on his hands. What are the FEF NRA reporting requirements when things get legal?
When a registered rep or a member firm gets sued or is subject to a written customer complaint involving allegations of theft or forgery or is indicted for any crime, these are classified as specified events. They are major red flags. These specified events must be formally reported to FEMINRA within 30 calendar days of the firm learning about them.
And who actually fills out the form and reports it? Does Riley have to call FEMINRA and tattle on himself?
No. This is another nuanced trap. Specified events are reported by the firm, never by the individual person directly. The firm's compliance department handles the fine and error reporting, and there are specific dollar thresholds for civil litigation or arbitration settlements that automatically trigger this reporting. If the individual rep, Riley, is settling a claim for more than $15,000, or if the firm itself is settling a claim for more than $25,000, it must be reported.
Let's talk about arbitration, because that's where this is heading. Ingrid wants her $1 million back. She filed an arbitration claim. What are the time limits here? How long does she have to complain?
Disputes in the securities industry almost universally go to FINRA arbitration, not regular civil court, because clients sign arbitration agreements when they open accounts. A crucial rule to know is the statute of limitations for FINRA arbitration. Claims are absolutely barred after 6 years from the event that caused the dispute. If Ingrid waits 7 years to complain about the spray-painted alpacas, she cannot go through FINRA arbitration. The window is closed.
And what happens to Riley's permanent record through all this? His Form U-4?
Form U-4 is the central employment record for a rep in the securities industry. Whenever there is a significant event in Riley's life or career, like a customer complaint, an arbitration claim, an arrest, a bankruptcy, or even just a change of home address, his Form U-4 must be amended. The general rule is the U-4 must be updated within 30 days of the event.
But there is an exception to that 30-day rule for the really bad stuff.
Yes. If the event involves what is called a statutory disqualification, like a felony conviction, a misdemeanor involving securities fraud, or being expelled from the industry by another regulator, the U-4 must be amended much faster, within 10 days.
The hammer comes down hard and fast for the bad stuff. Okay, we have covered an immense, staggering amount of ground. We have followed Sam, Riley, and Ingrid through the entire chaotic life cycle of a disastrous private placement. We have unpacked the why behind the rules. It is time for the outro. Let's do a rapid-fire recap. We are going to trade off firing out the absolute highest yield, most testable takeaways from this entire deep dive. These are the flashcards. I'll start. Correspondence is 25 or fewer retail investors in a 30-day rolling period. Institutions do not count toward the 25 limit.
Credis D exempts an issuer from registration, not from fraud. You can never lie, and there is no reasonable care defense for failing to register.
Form D must be filed with the SEC 15 calendar days after the very first sale in a Reg D offering.
To calculate an accredited investor's net worth, you must exclude the positive equity of their primary residence.
Interstate exemption rule 147 has a strict 6-month limit on reselling those shares to out-of-state residents.
Contingency money in a best efforts offering must sit locked in a separate bank or escrow account until the contingency is met.
Never accept a verbal sign-off for opening a new account. It legally requires a principal's physical or electronic signature.
Reg BI is specifically for retail customers. Suitability is for institutional customers. Identify the customer first. They never overlap.
Issuers call bonds when interest rates fall, forcing the investor to face reinvestment risk.
Written customer complaints are kept at the OSJ for 4 years. And Form U-4 updates in 3 days or 10 days for a statutory disqualification.
That is the core of the Series 82. We have wired it into the brain.
It really is. If you understand the mechanics of those points, you are in incredible shape.
Now, before we let you go, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Something that connects this dense regulation we just spent an hour discussing to the real, breathing world of finance.
Think about this. The accredited investor wealth thresholds, the 1 million net worth, and the 200K income requirement were established decades ago. They haven't fundamentally changed since the 1980s. But think about the massive compounding inflation we've had over the last 40 years. If regulators actually adjusted those exact numbers for inflation today, millions of people who are currently considered sophisticated enough to buy private placements wouldn't even come close to qualifying. It raises a really important philosophical question about the industry. Are these stagnant rules actually protecting everyday investors from risky, glowing alpacas, or are they just walling off the most lucrative private markets to a grandfathered class of wealth?
That is a fascinating question. Does that 1 million barrier protect you from risk, or does it restrict you from opportunity? Something to mull over while you review your notes. Speaking of, don't forget to check out CertFuel.com to put all this knowledge to the test. We traverse the muddy, chaotic waters of federal securities regulations today, but hopefully the landscape looks a lot clearer now that you know the players. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep studying, remember the alpacas, and we'll see you next time.